So Marcus originally suggested that maybe I want to give a blackboard talk, which would be interesting, but I thought that if you wanted to see some results, I have to use a mix of the slides and maybe the two sides of the blackboard. So there will be some interesting theory issues where I'm sure it will become very quickly interactive. So I don't want to... Why is that not working? No, I just didn't turn it on. So basically, I would like to say a few words about, you know, how this fits into the composite Higgs mechanism, but you all know that, so I will be very brief on everything which is not lattice specific, because I think that's what you would like to see. Some results which the lattice can do, the controversies about the lattice calculations, and maybe how we can improve the lattice studies. We will skip that one. So obviously, if there's an unusual Higgs, a strongly interacting gauge theory is a candidate. There could be other candidates, but it is worth studying them. So this is a very rapidly growing activity in the lattice community. This map was empty about 3 years ago, and now there are lots of activities across the country in the so-called USQCD collaboration. USQCD is a big DOE-supported lattice effort with a substantial annual fund, probably coming out from our university funds, and there is hardware and software support from the DOE, and then we are supposed to do the good physics visit. How well we succeed, I don't know. That's the landscape in terms of activities. I would say in the USQCD BMS effort, we have of the order of 40 people or so, 40 to 50. Depends on how you count, David, you know, students, postdocs, and everything. So we would like to take a gauge theory as a basic to tell whether it is chirally broken or not. That should be an obvious first requirement. Then we would like to study detailed properties. That's what everybody is interested in. There is one thing I am not going to touch in this very limited scope. I have nothing useful to say about fermion mass generation. We are going to restrict ourselves to the somewhat arbitrary defined restricted theory space, where we just look at those strongly interacting gauge theories in the chiral limit when the fermion mass vanishes and see what we can learn from them. Now, the computing technology, as I said, really changed in the last few years, I would say enormously. So I show you the newest candidate or toy we have. That's a video card. So the kids love it. Now that video card has in it about 500 processors. So what you do nowadays, or what we do, is that, you know, like in San Diego, I got a Recovery Act, a grant from the DOE, that we build clusters where in each node of the cluster, you have on the motherboard four slots where you plug in four of those beasts, and then you connect them as an ordinary computer cluster. So that way, you can have two racks of a supercomputer, you know, on the scale of 50,000 processors in it. The only limitation is that you actually have to program this thing. And the programming paradigm here changed a lot, because now you have parallelism inside the video card, and then you have the parallel structure of the computer cluster itself, and you have to deal with this. But it is doable, and that brought unexpectedly large, you know, improvement in computing power. So we can do a lot more nowadays than maybe a few years ago. It is unbelievable technology, and I don't want to spend time on it, but just one thing which you probably would appreciate. The processor on this card is a single chip. That chip has in it 3.2 billion transistors on this single chip. So it's remarkable. So theory space, lattice goals, and the three notorious issues which we are trying to deal with and sometimes trying to turn them to our advantage. Not always. There's not much we can do about the finite cutoff to turn it to the advantage, but we can turn the finite volume and the small fermion mass definitely to our advantage. So that's our theory space. So I plotted here all the ongoing activities in this strongly interacting gauge theory space, which we have right now in USQCD, in the BSM group. And you can see the following, that first of all, we have four different fermion representations in the color space, which are the fundamental, the adjoint, two-index symmetric, and two-index antisymmetric. The truth of the matter is that the two-index antisymmetric is untouched yet for a number of reasons, but there are activities in all the other three. So, for example, in the color flavor space, for a given representation which I color coded for convenience, you see here at three color, you are trying to move along this line and reach the lower edge of the conformal window, and you try to figure out what this guy actually does. You want this guy to be controversial, because if it is not, it's hopeless that it does what you hoped it would do, voking or whatever else, right? So you want a theory which is very close to the conformal window. And this one you can, you know, use as your homework exercise, that you know what you are doing, the LF equals 16. So that is the fundamental set. All those circles are being looked at. Then there is the red color coding, the two-index symmetric. There is the SU3 work that's also very controversial, very close to the conformal window. And then there is four colors, which is a calculation a group just started. And that is what we would call the sextet representation, right? Two-index symmetry with three colors. Then we have SU2 fundamental, and there is also the adjoint representation, that point. That's a single point which has been studied. So I would like to show you a little bit of the results and the problems and how we try to deal with the problems on the lattice. Clearly, that's the region where we would like to be. And we don't know whether any of those models would deliver this, right? So if you impose a single constraint, if you will, that is there a point in that theory space which does things like voking coupling with chiral symmetry breaking, a composite Higgs, whatever it is, etc., we don't know whether any of them would deliver it. Of course, we know that QCD works to some degree, the way it is described in the textbooks in the old technicolor context, but that's not what we want. So we are looking for this kind of scenario with the coupling constant. And here, of course, you will see that there is already an issue. But if there is a fixed point and you are inside the conformal window, then you can start speculating how does that beta function continue. And I will show you the minimal picture, the way we understand it, and then we can add speculations about what happens if you have a new phase, a new UV fixed point at some later point, etc. Those things have not been investigated yet on the lattice, because you will see that we have enough problem just to deal with this guy here. I also should add that, depending on what news we will hear from the LHC in terms of the Higgs, light, heavy, none, you know, even a light Higgs can be an unconventional Higgs. This is a very controversial topic theoretically, but if you are very close to the conformal window, one of the questions people are pressing, very controversial, whether you can view that situation as a broken dilaton. If it's a broken dilaton, then you wonder whether the scalar particle produced dynamically close to the conformal window could be viewed as a somewhat funny Higgs particle, light and narrow possibly, but not delivering the coupling switch, otherwise you would have in the standard model. So that's another interesting and controversial motivation. Now, what I would like to point out that as you vary NF in a given representation, then your landscape of understanding the strongly interacting gauge theory as a field theory suddenly changes. Why and how you can continue in NF, that's a speculation, but the change is there. So I would like to describe what that change really is. So in an ordinary QCD-like theory, you have the UV fixed point, and you have a huge coupling constant space. You have the gauge coupling, you have all the irrelevant couplings, and then you have the fermion mass. That's your infinite dimensional Lagrangian space. It's useful to think about this way because if you find that UV fixed point is a finite lattice cutoff, you have a continuum theory along a particular line, which long, long time ago, you know, Wilson designated as the so-called renormalized trajectory. So the renormalized trajectory, you have continuum physics even in the presence of the cutoff of your theory, because you added so many irrelevant operators that you eliminated all the cutoff effects, crudely speaking. That construction has been done almost exactly on the UV fixed point and approximately on this trajectory in QCD. So we know that it is possible to simulate at finite cutoff the continuum theory, so to speak, but it's very complicated because you have to add a ton of terms to the lattice Lagrangian to achieve that goal. So what we really do is that we run like mad on that axis, ignore all those couplings, or we add a few with the hope that you are actually closer to that RT trajectory, and you hope that when you measure infrared stuff on that lattice, then it is like getting very close in terms of the normalization group argument to this RT trajectory, and you extract continuum or continuum-like physics. So that is the goal in a QCD-like theory and below the conformal window. Now, in the conformal theory, where I must say that I just don't know nearly enough about the conformal aspects, so I will describe it as an infrared fixed point in a field theory sense. You have that infrared fixed point, you have a trajectory in the critical surface where the fermion mass is zero. But then you also have a mass deformed conformal theory with a new RT trajectory which represents mass deformed conformal theory. It's a continuum theory, and those two theories are not the same. So if you are moving on this line, don't look for the UV fixed point supporting you. It won't be there. But nevertheless, that's a continuum theory. And that is the mass deformed continuum theory. But the truth of the matter is that you most of the time work with theories at finite fermion mass where you try to approach the critical surface. So from this UV fixed point, you have a number of RT trajectories coming out which describe the different fermion masses defined in the UV sense in the theory, like in QCD. In QCD, from here you can start all those massive QCD theories in terms of the fermion coming out. Same here, and the idea is that if you are close enough to the critical surface, they roll slowly close to the infrared fixed point and sort of get very close to this RT trajectory, which represents the true mass deformed conformal theory. But if you pick a point somewhere in this space and you do lattice simulation, you have to be very careful exactly where you are located in terms of this landscape and exactly how you want to accomplish the controlled approach to this critical surface and the infrared fixed point. It also shows you that if you deal with ordinary lattice cutoff actions, you are never going to get to the infrared fixed point. This infrared fixed point in a lattice scheme has a ton of operators which you don't know what they are. The best hope is that you are approaching the critical surface and get close enough to it, and from that approach you tell what you have. So I want to show you how controversial, how quickly it becomes controversial in lattice calculations. So that is the original calculation of Thomas Perkis and company, where they used the Schrödinger functional and tried to calculate the running coupling as a function of the volume. I already should emphasize that there are lots of ways of running the coupling with the volume. That's just one of them. What you do here is probably well known to most of you, so I don't want to get into the details. I would be happy to discuss the details because they are actually for the lattice guys quite important, but not here. You introduce an external field inside the box, and basically you define a coupling constant as measuring the fluctuations around that external field. And that will depend on the size of the box, and then you vary the box size, and then you get a running coupling. Now, the three lattice curses are hanging as a cloud over every lattice calculation: finite volume, finite fermion mass, and the cutoff. In this case, very cleverly, the method deals with the finite volume. It turns it to your advantage. The finite mass is not an issue because with appropriate twisted boundary conditions we have here, you can run the simulation at exact zero fermion mass. That's not a problem. The cutoff is a problem. So therefore, when you produce a curve like this, you should ask Tom and company exactly how you controlled the cutoff dependence in the calculation, that I can view this as a continuum result where the cutoff is removed. How do you try to remove the cutoff in a calculation like that? That you take a fixed volume, you measure the renormalized coupling, that you can do very well. Now you double the volume and you measure the change in the renormalized coupling. So you had a volume which had a L10 and you double it to 20 and you measure the change. Now you say, okay, I'm done, I measure the beta function. Not quite, because you do that at a finite bare coupling and a finite cutoff. So what you do is that now you take another bigger volumes and tune the bare coupling to the exact same renormalized coupling which you had at 10, and then you double it again. And you get a delta beta, which is now slightly different from the one you measured before, because you change the bare coupling, so you notice a cutoff effect in the delta beta, in the change of the beta function. And we know from theory what the cutoff dependence of that delta beta is. It leading order, it is a square over L square. So if you do that repeatedly many times, in principle, you can extrapolate to L equals infinity, because the cutoff dependence will go down with 1 over L square, and in principle, you get a result which is a continuum result. What makes, in this case, it even more tricky or interesting, that because we are sitting close to the edge of the conformal window, the question is, to what degree can the simulation fool us? You know that we have that trajectory going very close to it. Is it going close because it is still a chirally broken theory which will not make it, so to speak, and prefer the other landscape? Or is that a true reflection of the infrared fixed point? It just shows, you know, what kind of results you can get. That was one of the very, very early results. Almost at the same time, we also
what is L naught?
Oh, that is basically the, yeah, no, L is the L measured in Lattice spacing unit. So you start from a fixed L0, and then you keep growing, and at the end you try to match this to a physical scale. You only do it in the sense that you do that step function thing where you keep changing the bare coupling, and in that sense you actually do. Yeah. Yeah. So it is basically because the smallness of the volume is not restricting you. So you can start from a femtoword where in physical units, you know, the original lattice size was 0.001 Fermi, and then you can keep going. And actually they stop around, you know, in this case we don't know where they stop because we don't really know this theory. In a QCD-like theory you can do something similar. Of course it would run up the coupling instead, and you can again go through several orders of magnitude, but not so many. The blue dot would be the original two-loop expectation. Oops, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, right. So that one, so they start from V coupling and it saturates, so to speak. And then they go to a very strong coupling, tuning to strong bare coupling and hoping that they can measure well a strong renormalized coupling. And they try to argue that it has a black backflow. So therefore they try to argue that you are sitting at the minimum of that basin, which will be the infrared fixed point. So it's good that you pointed it out because this is quite important for their conclusion. Yeah. So that is their argument why they are perhaps sitting at the bottom of that basin. So we, just as a first exercise, we measured the running coupling from, yes?
Even before that, there was a paper on the finite temperature transition as a function of NF, and they claimed that, I think it was Brown and Giese or something, I don't remember the name.
Oh, this theory, approximate theory paper, from Schwinger, Dyson, I think.
No? It was a lattice calculation. They actually calculated the critical, you don't know about it?
No.
And I just wanted to know if you had a comment on it.
At NF equals 12?
Yeah, as a function of NF, and it was before any of this. It was actually...
I don't even know about this paper.
I just wanted to know if you had a comment.
Yeah. No.
Which concluded that at NF around 12, the temperature of the phase transition went to zero and stayed zero for all NF bigger than 12. So, I mean, my question was just, should I believe it? I mean, so, but...
Well, I will show you our result where we have a finite temperature transition at NF equals 12, but that also can be criticized, of course. So the results, I mean, the modern results, I don't know when that paper was produced. I should know. I should know about it. Okay. Did I say otherwise?
No, I'm just saying.
Yeah, okay. I will show some finite temperature results because that's one of the potential tools, right? So here, if you define the running coupling from the force itself, which you can do, then you see a much stronger running. And you can analyze that it's sort of not in agreement with the Schrödinger functional running. Now here, again, I should go through all the pitfalls, mass, volume, and cutoff. Now the mass, I think, can be handled, although it has to be handled with care because you don't directly simulate at zero mass. The volume you can also handle because you can run even that coupling with the volume if you want to, or you can push the simulation such that those points are volume independent. Those are fairly big simulations, like this plot, for example, has a 48³/96 full fermion simulation in it, a tiny fermion masses with 12 fermions. This kind of thing was unthinkable 5 or 10 years ago, that we can do such simulations. So that is just one illustration for the kind of controversies we have. Now,
one just sort of general comment.
Yes.
About these, both of these things. You know, if you're thinking of this, then you're looking for a conformal field theory. It's not clear that, you know, non-local things like this are really well-defined observables with well-defined conformal behavior. You know, the things that are natural in conformal theories are correlation functions, dimensions of operators. You know, these things, even though we think about fixed points, you know, perturbatively, I mean, like for the Schrodinger functional or this force law, it's not clear to me that a conformal phase makes some very clear prediction.
Well, I mean, I mentioned an example along this line that although I'm not, I don't know enough about the conformality, but you know, if you have this infrared fixed point, then on that fixed point, you can write down an RG equation for the V-zone loop itself and the infrared property, and it is scale invariant. So there are various interesting objects you can look at. So for example, this theory.
This potential is essentially a right, it's
essentially. So in other words, you know, we should not see this kind of force in the limit when m goes to zero in a large volume if it were in the conformal window, if it were inside the conformal window. But then here, I hear the kind of legitimate questions that how do you show that in the limit when the fermion mass goes to zero, that confining nature of the potential survives? Or like, why don't you break this string? Well, we know that we don't break this string because we are well below that string breaking distance here. And then you have to continue, and we did continue, and I'm not claiming that this is a proof that this is a non-conformal theory, but it is just one illustration what kind of things you can do. You have two plots because on one plot we just show the fit on which is a phenomenological fit, which doesn't mean much. On the other plot, we show how the one loop, two loop, three loop running of that alpha QQ coupling constant would do, and how the simulations are actually running even faster than the three loop. And that is at an alpha value, which is around 0.03, 0.04 at short distances. So the expectation there is that if you are at a low enough fermion mass, they should run with perturbation theory or lower, but not higher. Remember, the Apelkist curve was running with the three loop. So in other words, we have been unable so far to match this running coupling to the Schrodinger function and running coupling. There is some ill-understood discrepancy between the two run. It is not saturated. Not yet, anyway. So as far as we can go, and therefore it remains a little bit of a question mark. Now, recently we got into an interesting controversy with the Yale group. I will show you examples, and they bring up interesting theoretical questions, why and how we are dealing with this controversy in the NF equals 12 case. So I just want to show you a few results and why and how we got into this controversy. So fundamental representation, the two most interesting, as I mentioned, 12, and in a way 16, if you want to exercise everything you know about lattice gauge theories, which is not, you know, highly recommended, but certainly it is something which we should do well for the trademark. We haven't done that. We jumped into the whole thing, but recently we started doing very carefully NF equals 16 just to demonstrate that every piece of the technology we apply, at least in that case, is under systematic control. There are various groups moving along this line. NF equals 12 is founded in the US by the Yale group, which grew into the Lattice, the LSD collaboration, Lattice Strong Dynamics, and our group, which is the Lattice Higgs collaboration. Ben Svetitsky likes to say that he's not sure which acronym he finds more annoying. And then there's a third group at Columbia, Gina and Mahini mostly, and Norman Chris, who are studying the finite temperature transition for the NF equals 12 model. And then there is Anna Hasenfratz in Boulder, who is using the MCRG. And you will see that the results are just as controversial as it gets. Problem is not doing NF equals 12. I'm just talking about, but we will come to the sextet. There we have our other controversy in the sextet model, which is the other very interesting and controversial model. So first let me show you something which is a glimmer of positive hope that it makes sense to study those models. So that's from LSD and a recent S-parameter calculation that they try to show that the S-parameter does not scale with NF as it was expected in the old days. That should be viewed as a very positive result because, you know, when, you know, at lunchtime discussion before Sharma became the Higgs coordinator, one of the Higgs coordinators of CMS, and the topic of Technicolor came up. They said, oh, I killed Technicolor three times. He said, well, one of them was that everybody thought that that some of the S parameter will come out way too large and you cannot accommodate the electroweak precision. Now, there are two ways to see why this is probably not true, that the S parameter is not the biggest threat. One, we definitely see very well established parity partner near degeneracy in the spectrum when you are below the conformal window. If you have that, then from the Weinberg sum rule spirit, you already know that your S parameter calculated phenomenologically will come out much smaller than it was before. In the early estimates, people just plugged in scaled up QCD. And when you get close to the conformal window, the spectrum doesn't look anything like scaled up QCD anymore, including the very rapid approach to near degeneracy of the parity partners, what you would actually expect. So that's at least a positive thing. So what do we do? I want to show you in spectrum calculations and also a little bit in the finite temperature calculation. So in spectrum calculations, obviously, if you want to propose two hypotheses and establish which one is more likely, because that's all you can do on the lattice, so you don't prove things. You can say that with some level of confidence, that's what I think. A theorist also should have some confidence level measurement in their calculations, but that doesn't happen. But that usually doesn't happen. The confidence level is always one in theory, or larger than one. So we have the chiral side, where we know how to analyze the system, because we have the Goldstone pions and the Goldstone dynamics, and the far infrared, we expect to see the Gasser, Leutwiller type chiral behavior. So that is the test of the chiral hypothesis. Now, on the conformal side, we also know quite a bit. We know that when we approach with the mass deform theory, we approach the critical surface, then the leading scaling behavior should be governed by that gamma exponent. So every mass should scale, including the pion, basically as m to the 1 over ym, which is that anomalous mass dimension, and also other dimension full physical quantities, say like the f pi, which of course doesn't have now the same meaning as it had on the left-hand side. and then we expect that the condensate will scale as this exponent with a nasty edit term, possibly more, which are basically coming from the UV behavior of this condensate. So that's the problem with the condensate and everything which is UV contaminated heavily, that you have to deal with somehow the contamination. So that is a more difficult object. Those are all infrared objects, so that can be tested. So what we did was that said, look, if you don't know which one, let's do the two hypotheses and see what we conclude from the spectrum, the properties, and this is how the war started. So we went through the measurements, and then at the end we did a global fit to all the channels and subjected it to the normal chi-square tests based on the two hypotheses, and then we got a result.
So what you did specifically was look at...
I will come to that. That is the second phase. Right now, yes, two-point function, you extract the masses from it, you subject them to the required scaling properties, and you test how well they perform. But then you go to the infrared of the scaling function to extract the masses. But now I also see that I can do a much more direct test on the correlator functions, particularly for the conformal theory, because I can push to very low M and just look for the correlator, the scaling behavior and the scaling violations directly of the correlator function, which is what we are doing now. So much appreciated the question. That's exactly what is going on. So it occurred, our evolution, which is slow, occurred in more than one step. First, we just went for the masses. You will see this story evolving. So we did that, and then we...
The first time was that it kicked in the... chiral hypothesis.
Pardon me? The chiral hypothesis was just based on chiral perturbation theory.
First thing you showed was a fit to that.
Yes. Yes. So I showed the fits to the chiral hypothesis. Yeah, but the trouble is that when you fit individual channels and you don't pay particular attention to the details and don't look under magnifying lens the various exponents, it can be misleading. For example, on the conformal side, you can also produce fits which look okay, but then you notice that the exponents change from channel to channel, and they should not. And that, unless you improve your, that's not a fit, so that gives you a very bad chi-square, which then made Tom unhappy, and then we started discussing what the hell is going on. So that's exactly what happened. So when at the end of the day, basically, we found that the confidence level, what we got on the chiral side was of the order 1, and the confidence level on the side of the conformal hypothesis was of the order of 9 or 10. Now that, those are sums, so when I say 9, it is really 9. Now that is the true confidence level of the conformal hypothesis, chi-square, the degree of freedom about 9. That's a terrible chi-square. We have a huge number of degrees of freedom, so clearly the conformal theory subject to this test totally fails. Now here comes Tom and says, okay, but what if you add terms to your conformal fit, that you add non-subleading terms and then try to see what kind of fitting you get on the conformal side. So they wrote a paper on it. And let me try to explain how they dealt with this. I don't think they dealt with it the way it should be handled, but they made a first step. And we made a second step, which I think was critical to this analysis. So first you realize that you can do conformal leading order scaling in the limit when you assume that your data is in the limit where the volume is infinite. How you do that, that's just a boring exercise. You keep increasing the volume at fixed bare coupling and fermion mass as much as you can to see whether you get spectra which are now volume independent. And that normally works because asymptotically that mass dependence with the volume becomes exponentially suppressed. But we know that underlying it, we have a well-defined scaling theory going back to Wilson. So that fixed point has to be understood at least as well as Wilson would try to understand it. And this is where the scaling analysis becomes relevant and also the deviations from scaling. So what happens in the true analysis is that you have the measured function, like the free energy. For the singular part, you can write down what Fisher originally guessed, and Bresen and Zinsjusten and others in the early days proved the field theoretically from the normalization group, that you expect a scaling behavior for masses like any correlation length, which is a scaling function of that scale variable x, which is L times m to the 1 over ym, and the correction terms, which at fixed x go down with the omega exponent, which in a normal situation should be the derivative of the beta function at the fixed point in a conformal theory. Now, if you play with your new theoretical ideas, you might change that, but in a normal situation, that's what it should be. And we know that this is expected to be a, you know, robust feature of the theory, just like the existence of the fixed point. So that's what you get on that side. Now what, so Tom knew that to defend the conformal hypothesis, he had to change the ansatz. So he changed the ansatz in a very ad hoc way based on some QCD intuition, which may or may not be right. That intuition would argue that, well, you know, in the far infrared, you freeze out the fermions, you have a confining theory, and then they started writing down M dependence coming from that picture, which were basically analytic terms they added to the ansatz. But that clearly shows that the leading corrections will not be analytic, but they will be some exponents which the theory in a universal way should determine. So they made a fit, and then they wrote a paper that we can fit adding analytic terms to the ansatz, which is certainly true to some limited degree. It was, I say, a limited degree because they cherry-pick some channels, but that's okay. So it certainly improves the fits if you add those analytic terms. But then we said, well, actually what we really should do is to apply now to the masses like this one. Oh, and that they did in the infinite L limit. So they did not take make part of the test the volume dependence of the scaling, just the infinite volume limit based on our data, without calling us. Now Tom said, okay, next time I will call you before we write a paper on your tables. So we did that, and again we got terrible fits. So if you try to subject now the theory to the finite size scaling theory in finite volume based on the masses, again you get a bad fit, and they saw that bad fit at Lattice 2011 in Squaw Valley. We just came back from there a couple of weeks ago, and they are now thinking what the next move will be. So it is an interesting back and forth, which is fun as long as you think you are doing okay, but I don't know. Now, to be honest, I also show you a So that's where the controversy is right now. I cannot emphasize enough two things, which is our own limitation. We don't have precise test of that term yet. And I know that some people here, like Marcus, are interested in all kind of interesting ideas how to probe the approach to the critical surface and infrared fixed point. And all I can emphasize that we are now into it on the lattice. We know exactly how this can be done, at least in the leading picture, before you add new operators, potentially interesting operators, and you can turn the finite volume into a very powerful tool, because your infrared fixed point will control this finite subscaling behavior and its violations. And that's a beautiful example, needless to say, that in simple condensed matter system that was studied to death, and people extracted to very good accuracy the subleading exponents of irrelevant operators and the rest. And that's what we should be doing big time if we are really after the conformal properties in a serious way.
I can't resist saying that that's what I said in a paper in 2007 when Applequist and company were first calculating beta properties. I said exactly that and suggested some specific observables, so I'm very happy.
And he should listen to you more.
It sounds like the result is
a mess.
But we know there has to be a window, right? Well, you don't think so? At NF equals 16, 15, 14, right? Stop somewhere, right? So, you know, and sort of by definition, where it stops is going to be, can't be weak coupling, because in weak coupling we keep seeing a two-loop fixed point. So, something interesting.
Wait, the sign of the breakdown of confinement of the temperature.
That I am showing you here now, because I skipped it, that if you look at the deconfining temperature, then there is now consistent indication from the Columbia group and us that there is a phase transition at NF equals 12, and you go from a chirally broken to an unbroken phase. You can see it in the condensate order parameter psi, and also from the Polyakov loop. There is a sudden change, which of course, if you believe...
From
at zero temperature, all that. No, we don't have 10, we have 8.
Because you have to have multiples of 4?
Unless you are routing the Steget fermion, and that's why we do 8 and 12. I didn't mean that as a sudden change. Sudden change from the non-vanishing condensate as you vary temperature to a vanishing condensate. That's what I meant. Now, the change is indeed there, so the transition definitely becomes weaker and less pronounced as you go to 12 and you compare with 8. At 8, you have no doubt. At 12, you have some doubts about volume rounding issues and the rest. So this continues, but there are three groups doing it, the finite temperature, Columbia and us, we agree. The Palantan company still claim that they think that they don't see a phase transition. Palantan, Lombardo and company, and Italian group. So let me then, to be fair to the two sides, let me show an MCRG result, which is Anahaz and Frotz. Her hope is that doing MCRG, where you are basically measuring the bare beta function, which is at tall order when you are close to an infrared fixed point, which is at strong bare beta, that from a blocking matching all of your zone, if she would see a delta beta step function which is negative, she would interpret it as a backflow to the basin, to the minimum of the basin, and after a lot of trying at NF equals 12, she found a lattice action where she believes that she can see a visible a negative beta function, which she would interpret as a backflow, and therefore it would favor the conformer theory. I just wanted to show that I'm not pushing one particular interpretation. In fact, I am totally open-minded what this damn thing wants to be. I just want to give you a sense what can be done and what cannot be done when you are pushing the limits of the calculations.
Well, it's supposed to be seeing somehow as those red points are consistent with zero, and blue points are consistent with a backflow. Is that?
But she's trying to say that if she's using a naive action, she cannot tell. And then she added an adjoint piece to the gauge action, where suddenly her delta beta, the bare delta beta, will show negative values, which she would like to interpret as a backflow to the infrared fixed point. That's what she has. That thing, in my opinion on the MCRG, is that it is a very nice idea if you can do it right. But to do the MCRG under controlled conditions is extremely difficult, because you are matching in a 1, 2, 3 steps some heavily UV contaminated quantities, small V-zone loops and stuff like that, and she's leaving out all the flow related to the fermion. So only looking at the V-zone loops in this case is a very dangerous thing to do. Two-index symmetric, that's Legrand and us. That's the sextet representation. Now, Legrand there used the Schrödinger functional, and he announced results at least 3 times, which were published. First conformal, second non-conformal, third conformal again. So I'm not saying that malicious undertones, but that's a fact. And now he believes that's all right, because he, for the third time, he got it right. So he believes that they show from the Schrödinger functional, just like Tom showed it in NF equals 12, that it looks like a negative beta function backflow. I should add that their work is more limited than what the Yale group did, because they just do a few steps for that backflow. Whereas you could see in the Yale case, they try to follow it through over so many orders of magnitude in a very peculiar way. So that's not truly doing it, but in some sense.
Is it conceptually similar to the Hausenfrust thing? Because, of course, they don't actually double the volume, the number of lattice. They don't go 2 to the 4 lattice points each time.
Only in one. Yeah.
Step where they go back and readjust.
There is one big difference. Yeah, but there's one big difference that in Hausenfrust's case, you are doing that on the bare beta function. Whereas in the Schrödinger function, you are doing it on the renormalized beta function. That's the difference. So at least in principle, you can attempt a cutoff removal, whereas in the MCRG, you don't have any tool how you remove the cutoff. There you would have to hope that you actually get to the infrared fixed point, literally speaking. Whereas in the other case, you do it on the continuum.
In the Hausenfrust case, to have a hope of that, wouldn't you actually have to improve your action? I mean, you need to find the perfect action in some sense, no?
Or to show from the blocking that if you block the approximately infinite number of times, you really have perfect matching between the blocked and unblocked infrared theory.
If you're matching UV quantities, it seems like you need a finite lattice spacing.
No, but the blocking does what you are looking for. So once you block the lattice, your action changed infinitely. You throw in all kind of effective terms. So the blocking actually achieve that, because when you block n times in the infrared, you have a new action, and if it is truly continuum infrared with an infrared fixed point, that is your perfect action. So the blocking produces a perfect action for you. I mean, if you could measure those couplings. But instead of measuring the couplings in MCRG, you just match correlators, because very difficult to measure those couplings you have, after you block the lattice. They are there, but you have to measure them. There are some demon methods that people try to actually measure those couplings, but the perfect action is fabricated there via the blocking procedure. So We went through the same test, we got the same result, that the sextet model disfavored very strongly the conformal hypothesis. And in addition, there's a very nice new piece of work from Kogut and Sinclair, which only suffers from one thing, that Sinclair cannot use USQCD resources for their collaboration because Kogut is the DOE project manager of USQCD, so they only use resources outside USQCD for this work. And when I gave the hardware review, you know, the BSM review, you know, we had the hardware review at Fermilab a couple of months ago of the collaboration, and I gave the BSM talk. I had to go to an extra mile to assure all the reviewers that Kogut is not using a penny from the USQCD resources for their work. So they see a phase transition in the sextet model, and they are still working on it, but I just wanted to mention or illustrate again that people are trying to use all those tools, including the finite temperature transition.
That's a question. This is maybe a little bit technical, you know, we discussed this morning. And just about all of these simulations, you don't have enough chiral symmetry to completely prevent psi-barb psi from mixing with trace F-squared, for example. Right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So to some extent, you're always having to tune to get to the continuum, right? I mean, you have a, because you're... Is that correct? Is that an issue? That's sort of my question.
No, well, it is not an issue in the sense that if you can really go to zero with M, then of course you kill the UV part of the condensate.
The symmetry
that prevents... The U1 symmetry in that sense is protective enough for you.
No,
they can mix, but I don't think that will affect the chiral symmetry in this case, because you are just looking for the symmetry, nothing else. So the mixing, you know, the mixing...
You have a good, maybe is it a right translation to say you have a good way of looking for this tuning, namely you probe the symmetry, and so then you can find out what value of your...
Maybe the mixing, not, even in your case, is not an issue exactly in the chiral limit when the fermion mass is zero. That might be one way to look at it.
You know you're at the chiral limit.
No, you don't. You have to extrapolate there.
So that's a
you have to. You always have to extrapolate unless you try to replace it with some fancy, I don't know how to do that actually, twisted boundary condition for the finite temperature where you can directly simulate at m equals zero. So you always simulate. But if you buy into the Vilcek-Pisarsky University argument that for NF larger than 2, it has to be a first order transition, then this is supposed to be first order. So at a tiny but finite fermion mass, you do see the coexistence of two phases. Now, how strongly you can take that as a hint for a first order transition is not tested well enough yet. But you see these coexistent phases at a small finite fermion mass. I will skip the adjoint fermion. That's the only work which is less controversial than the others. I don't know why, because they think that they should be more controversial. So it's the adjoint SU2. Basically, it's a vector representation for the gluon. And at that point, they believe that they are inside the conformal window for this point, because they claim that everything they do is consistent with the fixed point of the beta function. They basically just measure the running coupling from the Schrödinger functional. But the two groups kind of agree, and some spectrum calculation is coming, so I don't know what will come of it. I will skip this one because I think that's a homework we should do, and we are doing it now, because if we think that we can really demonstrate that conformal scaling and scaling violation works in a controlled situation, that's a good place for it. And maybe I will I here you can do a very neat thing. You can do what originally Pierre von Baal was dreaming of, that under controlled condition you define a running coupling which runs with the volume, and because the fixed point is a V-coupling fixed point, it is actually quite possible that you can demonstrate that this running coupling runs out to infinity without getting into this tunneling phase before you get into the strongly confined QCD-like. Remember, in the old days, they showed how the femtoward was in a theory in a tiny volume. Then you increase the volume, and around 0.5, 0.7 Fermi, suddenly the system starts tunneling across the vacua. There's a very well understood vacuum structure here as well, when the fermions are included. And then you get over the barrier, and then it becomes so non-perturbative that you cannot follow it. Now here, it is not even clear whether there will be a tunneling picture which doesn't remain under control, because the ultimate fixed point itself is weak. So that would be a neat theoretical exercise. The rest I will skip. I leave the conclusions up there. And sorry, Marcus, but I didn't use the blackboard, which is in violation of the... Yeah. Maybe one more thing which I didn't emphasize enough, that, you know, David brought it up, that once you have the correlation functions, and we talked about it earlier today, then you can really subject them to very powerful tests dictated by the vicinity of that infrared fixed point, and we are just doing it, so I don't know what the outcome will be, but it's something which we should have listened to you more before. That's one way to look at it. I don't know whether you did it on the masses or directly on the correlators themselves or both, but all can be done.
Measuring the fact that I mentioned side by side.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what did you went very fast over the 16?
Yeah. Okay, let me, then, thanks for the question. I was dying for this question. So, when you have the, so you first you start in a small volume, and you have exact zero mass fermions, then what happens is that if in the spatial direction you impose periodic boundary conditions on the fermions and antiperiodic in the time direction, which you make long, so it's a transfermiotic spectrum you are looking at, then it turns out that the original 27 degenerate vacua of Toft and Lüscher reduced to 8, because you have a direction determined by the fermion, but you still have 8 exact degenerate vacua left. And at weak coupling, you are just fluctuating around one of them. At stronger couplings, you can start tunneling, and you will be tunneling still at weak couplings, it is strongly suppressed. Here I just show some simulations how that tunneling looks like. So you start. So that is exactly according to the expectations when you monitor Polyakov loops wrapping around the... You only have the two imaginary roots of the Polyakov loop left, and it is in three independent directions. That's how you get the 8 vacua. And if you follow that picture through, then we don't know what will happen, but if the coupling remains weak, that picture will freeze in an infinite volume. So in a large enough volume, that is the finite volume representation of the unparticle spectrum. Still non-perturbative, because the tunneling contribution will split the energy levels to some degree, but that's how the unparticle world looks like then in a finite volume. And it may very well be that the coupling will never get strong enough. This pair 0.5 is alpha of 0.05. That's the alpha. that this whole thing can be described by their control theory, to the degree Pierre and others described small bird QCD in terms of that tunneling picture. So that's basically the picture. If instead you impose antiperiodic boundary conditions for the fermions, then it changes the vacuum structure, but otherwise everything remains similar. So it's a kind of a cute toy model for lots of things.
Did you look at any just scaling type observables?
Not yet. No. No. First, we wanted to see the vacuum structure because it was, you know, an effective potential calculation Pierre and some others did at that time. You probably realize or recognize he gets some reference to it, but this second generation of, you know, twisted boundary condition, yeah, that all goes back to that time, basically, with various interesting wrinkles on it. You know, Unsal and Yoffe and other people working on those twisted boundary condition type classifications. All what we have seen. Okay, so what is plotted here is the time history of say the Polyakov loop, and the circles are showing how the Polyakov loop moves in time. So for example, on that plot, we know that in a given time spatial slice of the system, the Polyakov loop either has to be here or there according to the degeneracy of the two vacua. And you start at zero with the Polyakov loops, and you monitor them in X, Y, and Z direction, that's the color coding, and you see that in two directions, which is the X and the Y, the Polyakov loop moves out to this root, and in the Z direction it moves out to this root. And this is the demonstration of the 8 vacua, because if you do it in all combination, you have 8 possibilities. So the system really does exactly what it is expected to do based on the degenerate 8 vacuum picture. And this is practically at zero fermion mass. So the fermion mass doesn't play any role. In fact, we could run that at zero fermion mass. So we tested that a lot, but that would be the really useful next step, the correlators and their scaling behavior. Yeah.
And the exponents.
Yes.
All that you could calculate.
Yeah. Or you could calculate. You could even calculate the lattice, the cutoff corrections to it. So you could really compare your simulation with controlled theoretical calculation, whether you are doing the right thing or not. So that's a useful test or template. So that's ongoing, so.
Any other questions, comments?
If you want to do lattice calculation, you have to play video games nowadays.
Okay, I think Julius will be around the rest of the day, so let's thank him.